The following Women's Spaces show was recorded on Monday, May 2nd, 2022.
The woman in your life will do what she must do to comfort you and calm you down and let you rest now. The woman in your life, she can rest so easily. She knows everything you do because the woman in your life is you.
And welcome to Women's Spaces. My name is Elaine B. Holtz, and I'm your host. With me at the board is my friend, my partner, my engineer, and co-producer, Ken Norton. Good morning, Ken.
Good morning.
What a beautiful day in Sonoma County. It looks like it might be doing a little bit of a rain dance, and I'm really excited about that. We definitely need rain. Well, joining me on the phone this morning will be Dr. Harriet Fraud, one of my regular guests. Dr. Fraud is a mental health counselor and hypnotherapist and in practice in New York City. She is a well-published author and writes about the pressures on families and the economics of the United States of America. She's also a regular guest of the Dr. Richard Wolff's Economic Update radio show. For this show, we will be talking about women in the union movement. I will also be giving you some background into the Great Depression, what made it happen, and some of the issues that motivated organizing unions. What's so interesting is a lot of what is going on today has a familiar ring. I've mentioned this several times. My father was a union man, and boy, I tell you something, what I'm hearing is I heard all the time from him. And one of the things he always said, he never met a boss who would give you a raise without a struggle. Very, very interesting. Well, I have some shout outs to do on Sunday. This Sunday, we attended a wonderful wedding anniversary for Tim and Sharon Morgan. They were celebrating 50 years strong, and I just want to say congratulations to them. We had a wonderful, wonderful event at the Penrose Park, and I'll tell you something, it was just beautiful to see these wonderful people and experiencing and being part of the joy that they have in celebrating this wonderful, wonderful anniversary. Well, another shout out on April 28th, 1964. That's a while back. I gave birth to my daughter, Susan. Happy birthday, Susan. I'm so blessed to have given birth to her. Watching her be a grandmother is such a wonderful experience for me. And it was great. I got two celebrations with her. The first celebration I got to celebrate with her and my granddaughter, Amber, and my grandson, Ryan, and my great-granddaughter, Satori, and great-granddaughter, Kaya. We got to celebrate her birthday. And it was just a wonderful, wonderful event. Then we had a family party, and I want to thank everybody for attending. It was just a wonderful event. So happy, happy birthday, Susan. Well, today is a very special day when it comes to birthdays. I want to wish a happy birthday to my dear friend Celeste Austin, whose birthday is actually today. She reached a milestone, 70 years old strong. Oh, my goodness, actually 70 years young. You know, a special, special happy birthday. And in honor of Celeste, we have a special song that we're going to play. So let's go ahead. This is for Celeste Austin. Happy birthday, 70th year.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you.
Celeste Austin, happy, happy birthday. And this evening we're going to be celebrating with her. I'm really, really excited about it. I want to wish her a long, long life. And she's just one of these really special people. You know, every once in a while there's someone in your life that when you hear their voice, it just puts a big smile on your face. So I want to thank her for that. Well, you know, I want to do another shout out here. You know, yesterday was May 1st, May Day, and today people are celebrating it all over the country. And I want to do a shout out. We had a special International Workers' Day, Immigrants' Right Day of Action that would happen on Sunday. People went on a march, and I want to do a shout out to the people who organized it. It was Jobs with Justice here in Sonoma County, Great and Labor Center. And I understand the women had a wonderful, wonderful play that they put on. We were sorry that we were unable to go, but we heard it was just absolutely wonderful. Also, the North Bay Labor Coalition and the North Bay Organizing Project all put this on, and it was just an amazing, amazing event. And to my dear friend, who also has a radio show, Anna Silgado, I want to say congratulations for helping to put through a wonderful, wonderful event. Well, you know, May 1st is International Workers' Day, also known as Labor Day in some countries, often referred to as May Day, is a celebration of laborers and the working class that is promoted by the international labor movement and occurs every year on May Day, which is the 1st of May. I can't believe it's the 2nd of May already. I mean, here we are in the month of May. While it may be belong to a long tradition of spring festivals, the date was chosen, listen to this, in 1889 for political reasons by the Marxist International Socialist Congress. Amazing. Which met in Paris and established the Second International as a successor to the earlier International Working Men's Association. They adopted a resolution for a great international demonstration in support of working class demands for an eight-hour day. You know, it's very interesting when you look at labor. I did a lot of research, and Harriet Fraud and I are going to be talking about the women's labor movement. And I did a lot of research, and I'll tell you something. I see exactly what my father said. No boss will give anybody a raise without some sort of struggle. And the early struggles were very, very interesting because they were looking for safety. People worked. I could not believe when I ran into this. People worked from as long as 12 to 15 hours a day. 12 to 15 hours a day doing back-breaking work. And guess what? No breaks. They had to eat their lunch while they were working. No wonder people wanted to come together and unionize. I mean, it's amazing how people will not treat each other decently in the workplace unless you force it. And what's so interesting to me, like my father always said, he said that it's very interesting that all of a sudden when they go on strike, that these people come in and will work for, you know, instead of the strikers, the owners will, they call them scabs, will hire these people and they will go in place of the workers. They don't realize that they're hurting themselves. I mean, we need a decent wage. We actually need a living wage. $15 an hour is not a living wage. It's a beginning, but it's not a living wage. You know, May Day sequentially, became an annual event in 1904. There was a sixth conference of the Second International called All Democrats, Party Organizations, and Trade Unions of All Countries to demonstrate energetically on the first day of May. Well, it's interesting. I don't know if they celebrate so energetically as far as work goes, but we definitely had an energetic day on Sunday here in Sonoma County, and I'm proud that people come out like that. And they also had a woman's play, which was expressing the needs for women to have a little bit more respect in the workplace. And you know, what's really interesting, too, there was an incident. It's called the Haymarket Riot, also known as the Haymarket Incident and the Haymarket Offense. And this occurred in May 4th, 1886. So, you know, people have been protesting and trying to get labor organized for hundreds of years. You know, I thought it was just a recent thing in the 30s, but no, it's been going a long time. Well, this in May 4th, 1886, when a labor protest rally near Chicago's Haymarket Square turned into a riot after someone threw a bomb at police, 8 people died as a result of the violence of that day. And what that did was it sparked again the labor movement, which was later on, believe it or not, was squashed down. And we're going to talk a lot about that. But I just wanted to give you just a little bit of background, you know, about how important the labor movement has been. I mean, can you imagine, and you know, there are people that are doing this today. Can you imagine working 12 to 15 hours a day without a break? I mean, I can't even visualize that. I mean, it's just heartbreaking to me. And what about children? They put the children to work as young as 8 years old because families needed the money. And the reason they would hire children is because children were hired cheaper than adults. And I could not believe this one piece of information that I found is how much children made. Sometimes they only made 50 cents in one day. 50 cents for 12 hours labor? Oh, I mean, when I think about it, it just gives me the chills. And we have to look at it that way. You know, there are forces around us that could care less about people. All they want is the profits. They don't care about the people. They don't care about if the workplace is good, bad, or indifferent, as long as they're there working. But it's the unions that coming together that help with the higher wages, that helped and made an eight-hour day. Now we're looking at maybe 4 days a week. Of course, you can't. I mean, you have to have a life before, along with being part of a labor force. I mean, it's kind of interesting when you start thinking about it. And listen, there's a lot to think about in today's world, you know, and a lot of it is happening because we're not thinking and we're not paying attention, and it's very, very important. Well, here's the next segment that I love to do, and that's Our History is Our Strength. Why is that important? This is a woman's show. And once again, I'm watching the newspapers, and I'm still seeing more men with letters to the editor than women. I'm hearing more men on the talk shows than women. I mean, women are kind of in the background. You know, we need to come forward a little bit more. And that's the reason I do this, Our History is Our Strength, because I believe if we look at the past and look at what other women have struggled and accomplished, it gives us confidence. You know, I know when I'm trying to do something and I get frustrated and I say, oh, I can't do it, or it's too hard, or I'm afraid, I think of Ida B. Wells going into the South and writing on lynching. I think, wow, if that woman can do that, I can do this. And that is the whole idea of it. So let's go and look at our history, our strength. I mean, I'll tell you, I have to say it again. I am blown away because it's May. I mean, 5 months have gone by. It's like, you know, my great-granddaughter is going to be 6 months old. It seems like we just got the announcement. I mean, where does time go? It flies like a crow, let me tell you. Well, today's May 2nd, but let's go back one day to May 1st again. And this was in May 1st of 1950, Gwendolyn Brooks became the first African-American woman to receive the Pulitzer Prize for Poetry, named Library of Congress's Consultant in Poetry, later called Poet Laureate in 1985. What an honor! Gwendolyn Brooks, the first African-American to receive a Pulitzer Prize for poetry. What an accomplishment. Well, happy, happy day to you, my friend. And then let's look at some birthdays. In May 1st, 1830, wow, 1830, that's almost 90 years before we even got the vote. Amazing. It's a Mary Harris, Mother Jones, labor leader, organization's birthday. Well, Mother Jones really, really had an impact on the labor movement. So happy birthday. It's good to remember her. Then on May 3rd, 1912, and she made her transition in 1995, she's really, this was amazing to me. You know, I had the young people on about 2 weeks ago from Sunrise, and they were 17 years old. And I'm always so in awe of when these young women step forward and something happens. Well, when I discovered this woman, it just blew me away. Mae Sarton, she was a prolific writer, poet, and memoirist, published in Poetry Magazine at 17 years of age. She also taught at several universities, including Harvard and Wellesley. But to think this young girl, and back here in 1921, we just barely got the vote. It was 1 year after we got it, and you think that here's this young woman is 17 years old that is writing already for a publication. Now, a very important. We very rarely on women's shows pay much attention to our lesbian sisters. And this woman was born on May 5th, 1921. She made her transition in 2008. Dell Martin, who was a lesbian rights pioneer, who along with her wife Phyllis Ann Layden founded the Daughters of Blitis in San Francisco in 1955, the first social and political organizations for lesbians in the United States. They were the first same-sex couple to be married in California in 2004 and then again in 2008 when it finally became legal. Imagine what these women went through. Not only to get married, but there are two women getting married, but not only two women, but standing up as lesbians. I remember when I went to Sonoma State, and I was very involved in the Women's Studies Department, and that was one of the things I heard. There was no respect for our lesbian sisters. And let me tell you something. Once I got to know these women, and I got to understand, and I got to see that I have freedom of choice, I began to have a lot more respect, a lot more understanding, and a lot more acceptance. So happy birthday, Dell Martin. She made her transition in 2008, and she made an impact, as far as I'm concerned, with women. Amazing. Well, we are going to take a musical break. And you know, this is one of my favorite songs. I mean, it's not that it's such a great song. I mean, it makes me cry when I think about it. And again, I go back to my father and some of his stories telling me how the soup kitchens and what it was like standing in line and what it was like when they go to work and people were striking because they wanted unions and they had scabs and the police would go out there. I mean, it was a horrific time, especially after the Depression, I mean, in 1929. And we're going to be talking about that because that event could have been prevented, just like all the meltdowns in our country can be prevented if we start looking at being a little bit smarter and voting a little bit more intelligently. I think we can get a little bit further. But anyway, let me tell you, this is one of the best known. It's called Brother, Can You Spare a Dime? And it's going to be sung by Thea Gilmore. And this song is a reminder of what happens when workers have no protection. Brother, Can You Spare a Dime? Is one of the best-known American songs of the Great Depression, written by lyricist Yip Harburg and composer Jay Gorney. The song tells the story of the universal everyman whose honest work towards achieving the American dream has been foiled by the economic collapse. You know, and later on it was made famous by Bing Crosby and Rudy Valley. You know, it's really a heartfelt song. Well, when we return, I will be talking with Dr. Harriet Fraud, who is a mental health counselor and hypnotherapist in practice in New York City. Dr. Fraud is also a regular guest on Richard Wolff's Economic Update. And we will be talking about the history and implications of the labor movement. So let's go ahead, Ken, and play Brother, Can You Spare a Dime?
Once I built a railroad, made it run, made it race against time. Once I built a railroad, now it's brother, can you spare me a dime? Once I built a tower to the sun, breaking rivet and line. Once I built a tower, now it's done. Buddy, can you spare me a dime? Once in khaki suits, boy, we look swell. Full of that Yankee Doodle Dog. Then half a million boots went trucking off to hell. I was a kid with a drum. Oh, say, don't you remember? You called me Al. It was Al all the time. Say, don't you remember? I'm your pal, buddy. Can you spare me a dime? khaki suits, boy, we look swell. Full of that Yankee Doodle Dum, and half a million boots went trucking off to hell. I was a kid with a drum. Oh, say, don't you remember? You called me out, then it was out of time. Say, don't you remember? I'm your pal, buddy. Can you spare me a dime? Oh, buddy, can you spare me a dime?
Wow, what a song. Really brings back memories from a time that we're starting to go through again. You know, and they say, brother, can you spare a dime? Today it would be, brother, can you spare $5? I mean, a dime. You know, a dime was really a lot of money. I couldn't believe it that when I did the research, I actually found out that young people sometimes work 12 hours a day and made 50 cents. My God, can you imagine that? I can't. Anyway, for you folks just joining in, I want to remind my listeners that the opinions expressed here are not necessarily the opinions of the station, its board of directors, its members, and Women's Spaces. Well, welcome back. You're listening to Women's Spaces, and I'm your host, Elaine B. Holtz. The B stands for beautiful, by the way. Without further ado, I want to introduce my guest. Joining me on the phone all the way from New York, it is an honor for me to introduce her, and I like to think of her as one of my regulars, Dr. Harriet Fraud. Welcome, Harriet. Welcome once again to Women's Spaces.
I'm so glad to be here with you and your audience.
Well, we're very, very happy to have you, that's for sure. You know, Harriet, before we start, let me just give a little background of who you are and what you've accomplished. And also, if you want to add anything, please be my guest. Dr. Harriet Fraud is a founding mother of the Women's Liberation Movement in New Haven, Connecticut, and has been an activist for her entire life. She is a mental health counselor and hypnotherapist in practice in New York. Along with being a founding member of the feminist movement and the journal Rethinking Marxism for 40 years, she's been a radical committed to transforming U.S. personnel and political life. Harriet specializes in speaking and writing about topics in which psychology and economics overlap. All these topics remain loaded with taboos, confessions, ignorance, and fear, preventing us from being asking the big questions and daring to discuss big answers. So true, Mary. By analyzing issues where psychology and economics collide, we can better analyze our society and our individuality as well. She's written several books and is a mother and just a great, great person and a regular guest on Economic Update that we here have on our station here at KPBF 89.1 FM. So welcome, welcome once again, Harriet. Welcome to Women's Spaces. Anything you'd like to add?
No, I think you covered it well, and we should get into the meat of our exciting program today.
Well, I just got to ask you one question. Didn't you? Sure. I think when I remember our last phone conversation, you said you had a new podcast.
Well, I have a radio program, which is on WBAI at 2:30 on Wednesdays, Eastern Standard Time, and it's called Interpersonal Update, and I have two other podcasts. That's not a podcast, it's a radio program, but I have two podcasts. One is called Capitalism Hits Home, which you can find by just looking up Harriet Fraud, Capitalism Hits Home. And the other, It's Not Just in Your Head, about people being told that their problems are all in their own head and they could change them by eating right or changing their psychology. But when you're evicted, you understand that it's not just in your head. You'll be out on the street. And so I'm on that podcast, me and Liam Tate and Ikoi Hiro are trying to talk about the interactions of psychology and what's happening to people's lives in America.
Amazing. Just amazing. Well, that puts us right into the first question. You know, I'm really curious, Jimmy. You've been an activist for over 40 years. You know, talk a bit. You know, I always try to inspire people. You know, I offer a little bit of inspiration. So when you talk a little bit about the past and some of your challenges, that's usually what happens. So talk a bit about when you first became aware, say, of May 1st and why you believe it's important to celebrate this each year.
Well, I first became aware of it because I was told at Public School 81, where I went, that it was a day of celebration for trees. Well, then I came home and talked to my father about it, and my father was a radical, and he said, May Day is internationally acclaimed as a day of labor to honor the people who built everything. Everything that you see outside of you is a creation of people's work. And there's a lot of denial that it's work that builds everything. And there's a lot of dishonor for the people who do the work and don't get paid enough. And you should remember what May Day is, a celebration of the work that makes life possible.
Well, I know my father was a union man, and it was just amazing when May 1st came. I mean, he'd always talk about it and remind us and remind us what he went through in Chicago when they were trying to organize. It's really, really interesting. So, Harriet, I'd like you to go a little bit back in time with me because I think it's very important, and I've been thinking a lot about this. And I want to talk about the Great Depression and what have you found that actually caused it? And at that time, what was happening, particularly with women in labor?
Well, what caused the Great Depression of 1929 is what has caused the last many depressions of 2020, which was the dot-com bubble depression, and 2007-08, which was the stock markets selling and bundling mortgages that failed, or the recession, depression that we're in now because of our failure to contain COVID. We do have the most cases per person in the world, and also to curtail big business and give people a chance. And so I think they're all the depressions have been caused by a capitalism that is just driven to accumulate more and gets into risky and riskier territory in order to accumulate more money, and then finally fails. In 2007, the banks failed. They had overextended themselves, bundling up mortgages and then selling them, and then they were sold to speculators and their price went up, but the housing didn't, and the results were ignored. And now in 2020, it's because pandemic preparedness doesn't really pay for capitalists. What they want to do is produce something and sell it, not produce pandemic supplies and store them. So when Trump came in, he sold the few pandemic supplies we had, and we were utterly unprepared. And also, it was about everything becomes more and more about money at the top, and people become a means to make money, not human beings. And right now, we're in a situation where the economy is in trouble because we didn't handle the pandemic right. You know, all over Europe, Scandinavia, France, Germany, etc., the government paid companies between 70 and 90% of workers' salaries if they committed to rehire those workers at the end of the pandemic, if they had had to close. And they were priced and wage controls put on at the same time so they didn't have runaway inflations like we have in the United States. At any rate, then people got their jobs back and they could live. They could buy things. They could do things. They were not in arrears on their rent. And in countries like Germany and Berlin, there is a movement which is quite successful to make 140,000 units at the most profitable huge landlords stop paying rent because of the recent recession. We don't have any of that. And we had even fewer protections in the Depression. And so when the top got into trouble through overspending, And people lost their jobs. One out of every four people was unemployed during the Depression, and there was no backup. That was terrible. Now, because of people unionizing and struggling and working with FDR, who worked with socialists and communists and leftists, whoever wanted to make a change in the United States, and who taxed the rich at 94%, we have protections.
Yeah, but it was also interesting, too, that they passed what is known as the Glass-Steagall Act. And I'm going to just read something really interesting, because President Clinton, I believe, removed that legislation. The Glass-Steagall Act was a piece of financial legislation that dates to the Great Depression. It was part of a broader set of regulations known as Banking Act of 1933 that moved to restore confidence in the banking system after thousands of banks failed in the first year of the Depression. And it's really interesting that when we lifted this regulation,
right,
the provisions prohibited banks from investing in risky securities, though they could invest in government bonds, the legislation was designed to lower the risk of failure in commercial banks and help safeguard customer accounts. And there's also the Banking Act of 1933 also created the Federal Deposit Insurance. That's what we have when we see in the bank $200,000. When you put money in, it's insured to provide deposit insurance for banks and help prevent another depression.
That's right. But Clinton, under the pressure of capitalism, which he easily gave into, suspended that act. And so then in 2007-08, the banks failed again. And Obama chose to bring back the banks, to pay billions to the banks with no strings attached, which they've used to make sure that they can charge interest on everything, and didn't refund all the mortgage owners who were cheated. That's why more blacks lost wealth under Obama than any other president, because they were buying mortgages that were subprime because that's what people could afford. And so we're in real trouble. And we have been since then. And the Glass-Steagall Act isn't there to protect us from banks' irrational profiteering and spending.
Well, it's really interesting. What comes to my mind, I always think of when President Ronald Reagan was campaigning, he said, government was the problem. And, you know, that's really interesting because, of course, government's the problem. For capitalism, it's definitely a problem because they have regulations like the Glass-Steagall Act, you know,
exactly.
which stops them from screwing around. And it's really, in doing this show, I want you to know I did more research than I've done in a long time. And all I can say is that we as a population, you know, they talk about the media. We as a population are really blindsided by not getting the proper information that we need. Harriet, let's move into talking about, I'm very curious, I want to talk about women in the union. I know the one thing that spurred it was the Triangle Fire, all of a sudden when they were trying to unionize. It's really interesting. I remember I worked for a company, and we had a fire. It was a manufacturing company. We manufactured massage and facial equipment, and we had a fire, and OSHA came out. OSHA, which is the regulator for safety for workers, and they told us we had to have a certain fire system, and we had to have all these different things going on. And then they came back about 3 months later, and we still hadn't done the work. And it was really interesting. The owner said to the inspector, said, "Well, what if we don't comply in this amount of time?" And the guy just looked at him. He says, "Well, we'll just shut you down."
Good.
And I thought, wow, of course. I mean, I was so frustrated because we need a fire system. But here it is. We have these regulators in place that come out and say, you must do this or we're not going to let you function. And that slowly but surely is leaving us. And I think, and that's where the unions come in. So let's talk just a little bit. The beginning in the 1920s, unions were on the move and were quite successful, which gave us a middle class. What happened to disrupt the union movement? You know, here we had, talk a little bit about the union movement itself and then what it gained and then what you think was some
happened.
Of the disruptions.
Well, in the 1950s, 35% of workers were in unions. And of course, if that many people are in unions, they affect all workers because there's always that union shop you can go to where you can make more money. And what happened was that in the 50s, when after World War II, when Joseph Stalin was our biggest ally, they lost 30 million people during World War II, and where Uncle Joe, as he was called on the radio, was a great friend, and where every fourth family had an active communist member, the capitalists got really nervous, because during World War II was also when FDR, and right before the World War II, hired thousands of left people to rescue this country. And the capitalists were nervous. They were being taxed at 94%. They didn't want that. And they got together. And when FDR died and Wallace, who was not sympathetic to labor, got in, they started an anti-communist movement. Joseph McCarthy, who was the head of the House Un-American Activities Committee that was started, started to accuse anyone with a left opinion as being a communist and treasonous and about to overthrow our country. It's interesting that they weren't talking about overthrowing our country at all. The slogan at the time of the Communist Party was "Communism is the new Americanism." But he, with the help of the business community, created a hysteria that the communists are trying to overthrow our government. I think that's cute, because there was nothing in their literature about overthrowing their government, whereas the January 6th insurrectionist literature was all over about overthrowing the elections in our government, and they haven't been tried for treason. However, there were trials all over the United States, and in the late 40s, the AFL-CIO, which was headed by more conservative elements, made a deal with the State Department to throw all the communists out of the unions as traitors, and all the socialists as fellow travelers, and all the left-leaning people just believed in a strong union movement by tarring them with the communist brush. Well, what the leftists did for the unions was they organized more than just, we want not, 10 cents more an hour. They went into the community, and they tied up with socialist movements and communist movements and progressive movements of all sorts to get communities to cooperate and stand by workers on strike. And so their strikes were more successful because people were out there. Well, without that leftist spark, the union flame flickered until it's very little, and the AFL-CIO started cooperating with the State Department to hound communists and socialists all around the world, and the workers didn't have the passion. When you strike, you're not, let's say you win 25 cents an hour. It's going to be a long time before you make up what you lost, but you regained your dignity. And you had a sense, if you succeeded, that the community was with you.
Well, I want to
just that stopped happening.
I just want to throw something in, because, like I said, my father was a union man, and in my lifetime, I remember three strikes. And my mother just used to go crazy because they had a certain. They would give them a stipend, and then all of a sudden that would wear out. I remember one time they were on strike for almost 8 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a very, very touch and go. I remember cutting back on food and not being able to do certain things. And then all of a sudden it was over. And then before you know it, they had a better wage and things seemed to fall back in place. You know, as you're talking about, some of the different organization, I mean, I'm always shocked when I hear that there was so much input from the socialist movement and from also the communism.
That's been repressed from the history books. It's sad.
Well, and also the depression, you don't realize what was going on, because McCarthy, and then he was finally called out because it was an absolute sham. I mean, it was a disgrace to the country. But then the next step, I believe, happened was when the airline traffickers went on strike, and Ronald Reagan stepped in. What impact did that have, and what was that all about?
Huge impact.
What was that all about?
When the air traffic controllers went on strike, Reagan fired them all and broke their strike.
Right, I remember that.
And that was a kind of opening shot of destroying the unions. And now, I must say, there has been a union resurgence because the conditions of work are so terrible. And people like Sarah Nelson on the Flight Attendants Union. And
Harriet, let's hold that thought.
Okay, sure.
I want to take a musical break now. And let's and then come back and talk about what's happening here in 2022 and what's happening with all the union movement and why there is such an emergence. I mean, I think we went from a little bit of history to now we're going to get into what is happening in 2022.
Great idea.
So I'm going to play a wonderful song, and I love this song too. I mean, I'm sure, you know, we have to really start thinking about this. Like, whose side are we on? And that's really not a fight song. That's whose side is you on when you're thinking about it. I like to make lists. This is what you believe in. This is what you believe in. This is where I should be because I believe in this. I mean, that's how you decide which side is, what your values are. Actually, that's the question that's being asked here. So let's go ahead and play that. We're going to play Which Side Is You On, sang by one of my favorite singers, Beverly Grant. And also, when we come back, I will continue my conversation with Dr. Harriet Fraud. We were talking about unions and the strikes in the past and all the things that happened that led us up to today. So let's go ahead, Ken. Let's play Which Side Are We On?
Which side are you on? Which side are you on? Which side are you on? Which side are you on? Come all you poor workers, good news to you I'll tell. How the good old union has come in here to dwell. Which side are you on? 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 We're starting our good battle, we know we should win. Cause we got the gun thugs looking very thin. Which side are you on? 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 They say they have to guard us to educate their child. Their children live in luxury, our children almost wild. Which side are you on? 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 Workers, can you stand it? Tell me how you can. Or will you be a lousy scab or take a union stand? Which side are you on? 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 Don't scab for the bosses. Don't listen to their lies. Us poor folks haven't got a chance. Let's we organize. Which side are you on? 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 Which side are you on?
Oh my goodness, when I think of that song, I think of the Triangle Fire. You know, that when people were trying to unionize, and it was the only shop that did not unionize, and they had that horrific event happen. And, you know, as I also think about it, I also think I'm going to continue my conversation with Harriet Fraud. I'm also thinking about Frances Perkins, who was the first woman in labor, and some of the rules that she brought into some of the regulations. Well, welcome back, folks. You are listening to Women's Spaces. I'm your host, Elaine B. Holtz, and with me, joining me on the phone from New York, is Dr. Harriet Fraud, and we are talking about unions, and now we're going to talk a little bit about women in union and also what is happening today. Well, welcome back, Harriet, and
and I have a question for you. You know, here we are in 2022 and unions are in the rise again, you know, and it feels like the same thing that happened with the Triangle Fire and also bringing Frances Perkins in. And what's so interesting about Frances Perkins, and correct me if I'm wrong, she was definitely a socialist that had to become a Democrat in order for FDR to appoint her to the labor. So I think all that is so interesting. So talk a little bit about the Triangle Fire and also Frances Perkins and where we are here in 2022, how that all kind of comes together.
It does all come together because the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire was in an unorganized building. The owners of the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory had already had two dangerous fires and gotten away with it, and although 143 people died,
women
died, and 17 men, they were never put in jail. They were never even fined. But what happened was, as usual, women worked for less than what men got, and they had 11-hour days, 6-hour weeks, and no days off except, you know, for their one day off. And the conditions were terrible. The lint from the shirtwaists that were being sewn was in the air. There were overseers walking around, so if you stopped to take a breath, they came over. And if you went to the bathroom too much, well, let's say more than once, you were docked on your pay. And they worked like crazy. And the doors that would have let them escape for a fire were closed. They were locked in case people wanted to leave. They were locked and locked people in. The fire escapes were broken because they didn't inspect them and they were allowed to deteriorate so that the women were trapped in the fire.
Well, there's
get out.
There's another interesting thing about the locked doors that I found out. Another reason they locked the doors is because when the women were leaving, they wanted to make sure that they didn't take any piece of material or any threads or anything from the job.
So that they had people outside. When they opened the door to let people out, they had inspectors to inspect the women lest they steal some piece of fabric.
Right.
And the fire hoses came, the firefighters came, but their hoses couldn't reach the 10th floor, which is where the shirtwaist fire was. And so people saw young girls, because there were no child labor laws then. You could work starting at 11 and working up, you know, to people in their 20s, jumping out of the windows to their death. And it was a tragedy, and it was a capitalist tragedy because the owners would not accede to the union demands. Inspectors, you know, they saved money by not inspecting their factory and making sure there were no. They saved money by not keeping up the fire escapes. They locked people in lest they get a breath of fresh air or lest they walk with a piece of fabric, and so they were trapped and burned to death. And that created a big impetus for the union movement. And now there's a big impetus for the union movement because the top four employers are Walmart, Amazon, call centers, and fast food. And they all have monitors which the workers have to wear. And they have to perform their tasks within seconds. And if they aren't performing them, there's beeps that go off and reminders. They're not allowed to sit down. They're not allowed to stop. They're not allowed many bathroom breaks because that's recorded. Everything is recorded. And they're hounded. And the way their algorithms work to get staffing is to staff a little short. So everybody has to work overtime and fast. And so the conditions for the mass of American workers are terrible. And they were told they were essential during the pandemic, and now they're treated like crap, and that they're told they're replaceable and they're not important. That's what they told the employers at the John Deere factory who went on strike, and the Kellogg's factory who went on strike, and the nurses who have gone on strike for different reasons. The nurses in California were out more than 100 days. In Worcester, Mass., they were out 221 days, and they're going out not only for higher pay, but for the care of their patients, because big corporations have bought up the hospitals and have tried to run them with the same horrendous models that are efficient for making money and terrible for workers, so that nurses have too many patients and they can't care for them. They can't be sure that the medications they have are correct. The staff all the way down the line is cut and rushed, and so people are getting inferior care so that the capitalist corporations that own the hospitals can get more profit.
Well, you know, it sounds like the same thing with the Triangle Fire.
That's right.
I mean, it's denying protection. It's denying safety. You know, it's denying the ability to do your job fully, and it's also denying the humanism that you do have to go. Some people have to go to the bathroom. Yeah, sometimes you have to go to the bath. I mean, I remember once I had a bladder infection when I was working. I had to go 3-4 times an hour sometimes. It was really weird. I finally had to tell my supervisor. And of course, she said, yes, but we were part of a union at the time. So, you know, you could not deny a person that. So with everything that's going on, I mean, we're looking at Amazon now that just some of their places are
unionized. 8,000 are unionized.
Yeah, so here they are. So the motivation you're saying is because of the pandemic, when people were told they were essential, and then all of a sudden we're back to somewhat normal, and all of a sudden back to the same old, and people are saying, hey, enough is enough. So what do you see of the future of unions? I mean, we're coming, you know, we're speeding along here with our conversation. Time just is our enemy right now. But what do you think?
The future is very bright. One Starbucks union got organized in Buffalo, New York. Now there are 220 Starbucks, because they're inspired, 220 locations where they're trying to unionize. And 20 have already had successful union votes, because they're filing and organizing in 220 of them. The Amazon workers won without AFL-CIO support. They had their own union. They listened to people. They were organized primarily by Derek Palmer and Chris Smalls, who had worked for 5 years at Amazon and knew the conditions, and they listened to people. They listened. What's happening is people are not heard on the job, but when they organize, they realize their demands have to be heard. And that's what's happening all over. It's happening in academia. Grinnell College, every student that works is now in the union. Amazing. It's also happening all over newspapers. In New York, there are two big newspapers, the Daily News and the New York Times. The workers at those newspapers, the people who print them and work on them, are now organized into unions.
The New York Times?
Yep, the New York Times.
Oh, my God. My father used to rail about the Times.
They're an anti-union operation, but they organized.
What a step.
Ooh. The Writers Guild did, and Gawker Media did, all over. The Gannett papers have unionized, because as they buy these papers, the wealthy people, like Jeff Bezos, owns the Washington Post, and it's amazing. And Elon Musk owns Twitter. As they buy them, they start cutting back and making conditions where the workers are pushed and shoved and cheated. And so they're organizing. Even the delivery workers in New York are organized now into Los Deliveros Union, because, you know, they're from all different countries. A lot of them don't speak English, because there's takeout food now. They're picking up food at restaurants and taking it to people, and they were being systematically cheated and not even being allowed to go to the bathroom in the restaurants whose food they delivered. And they have won raises, and they have won protection, and they have won the right to go to the bathroom, which, by the way, is one of the demands an Amazon where workers often have to pee in a bottle.
Harriet, we're coming to the end of this segment, and I want you to give us your website and any suggestions you have for reading material and programs to listen to. I cannot believe how quickly the clock runs out.
Yes, me either. Okay, my website is harrietfraad.com, HARRIETFRAAD.com. My podcasts are Capitalism Hits Home, and it's not just in your head. My radio program is WBAI Interpersonal Update, and I just want to do a shout-out because women are the most militant unionists in the United States today. Sarah Nelson of the flight attendants protected them through all the cutbacks of the flight of the airlines. The nurses union keeps winning victories of, 700 nurses in one place and 500 in another. This is our time. And our time as workers, and we are doing it, and we support the union movement, which is now everywhere, from academia all the way to the hospitals to manufacturing. It's a very exciting moment for workers.
Well, my dear, I want to thank you so much for this wonderful, wonderful interview and for letting us know all there is to know about unions and some of the history. Well, that's it for our show, folks. Special thank you to Dr. Harriet Froad, who's a psychotherapist and hypnotherapist in private practice in New York City. She's a founding member of the feminist movement for the last and been working hard for the last 40 years. A reminder, tell your friends that Women's Spaces will be aired again at 11 p.m. this evening. I'm so excited I get to listen to my own show. And remember, our children are the future, and we must never, never lose sight of that. This is Elaine B. Holt. You've been listening to Women's Spaces. Thank you so much for listening, and I look forward to being with you the next time.
Oh, the woman in your life, she can wait so easily. She knows everything you do because the
The previous Women's Spaces show was recorded on Monday, May 2nd, 2022.